Helicopter parenting, millennial entitlement, and children who can't cope with failure. These are all the things that parents fear the most for their children, but what causes it and what can be done to prevent it? The answers are all in Allison Hawkins Ward's new book, Please Don't Come Home Except for a Visit, A Field Guide to Creating Independent Adults. Hey, Allison, welcome to my show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Steve. Happy to be here.
So you explain in the book how, you know, your own personal story. How did you come to write this book?
Well, I am an executive coach, and I work with business owners as well as directors and VPs in corporate America. And while I was helping them to get their businesses together and move ahead in their career, there seemed to be a constant theme where each of them had a child who was either in high school or headed off to college, or some who were even out of college, and who didn't quite seem to get it, weren't very focused, were still very, very dependent upon their parents, still living at home, perhaps on a couch, and they were frustrated. And so our coaching sessions oftentimes would turn into a parenting how-to, which made me realize just how sorely needed some guidance was.
Wow. Yeah, you know, this whole concept of helicopter parenting seems to be self-explanatory, but describe it for us in real terms.
Sure. So a helicopter parent is somebody who takes an overly protective view of their child's safety and or is excessively interested in the life of their children.
And that doesn't sound, well, when you use the word excessive, of course, define excessive.
Well, let me put it this way. If you're someone who is constantly, you know, Friday night, you're more involved in what your child's doing and their social activities than your own, that's kind of a problem. I mean, you want to set an example for what a healthy lifestyle is, and hopefully you have your own interests as opposed to being focused on what your kid is doing so much.
You know, I'm a baby boomer, and I was, for the first 12 years of my life, I was brought up in New York City, and my mother was a single parent, and she worked. And we, my brother and I, who is 5 years older than me, I mean, we roamed that city like it was, we owned that city. I mean, we took buses, we took trains, we did things that today would be considered to be kind of crazy and almost a, you know, lack of parenting, almost a parental abuse, I guess you could say, in terms of, you know, parents not really caring what their kids are doing. What is so different about the way parents view their children in that last generation versus this new generation?
I think there's a lot of reasons why our parenting has shifted. Certainly, the level of abductions that were happening in the 70s and 80s, that not only that they happened, but they were publicized in a way that they had not been before. Mm-hmm. So now we had this, you know, the whole term stranger danger, right, came about. And so that was a big phenomenon. I'll be honest, I think one of the other contributing factors, you know, I was also raised by a single parent, which was less common in the time that you and I were probably raised. Mm-hmm. And it's much more common now. And quite frankly, many mothers and fathers are investing more in their children because they don't have their own personal relationships.
Ah, yes. So in other words, your child becomes, in a sense, one of your friends or maybe...
Exactly.
Your best friend. But go ahead.
Exactly. And you hear that whole concept is my child is my friend. No, yeah. Your child is not supposed to be your friend. Mm-hmm. Your child is looking to you for guidance, right? Not to say you can't have a friendly relationship. I will tell you with my own daughters, you know, I remember when, I don't know what grade they were learning. My oldest one was learning about a democracy. I said, well, let me explain what a democracy, we explained what it was. And I said, we don't have a democracy in this house, right? I'm in charge. This is a dictatorship. And, you know, and now my daughters and I are extremely close. But at the same time, they're very clear that one person was in charge. They're not my friends. I mean, we are friendly. We're friends. Do you know what I'm saying? We're friends, but I don't rely upon my children for my social relationships.
You know, you describe in the book years ago when you went to college, you know, there was maybe a phone in the hallway that everybody was using on the floor. And also the price of a call was much more expensive. Back then, today we all have iPhones and instant access through Facebook and other social media. Does that contribute to this concept of helicopter parenting?
Without question. Technology has a huge impact on the helicopter parenting in terms of the ability to reaching out. Now I hear oftentimes people whose children are in college and they're texting and communicating with their child not only, you know, before it would be like maybe you'd call home once a week. Mm-hmm. Now it's not only every day, but it's multiple times a day. Every time the child hits a roadblock, they're texting mom or dad, you know, to solve the problem for them. The other thing that we can do we couldn't do before too now is, as you mentioned early on, Steve, about how you and your brother were roaming New York City and, you know, your mom had no idea where you were. Well, all I need to do now is pull up my iPhone and I know where everybody is, right? I can track my kids.
Yeah. And, you know, you even have the fantasy thought of maybe putting a little GPS thing bug under their skin so you know
Absolutely.
Where they are. All right. I mean, it's not crazy because we just kind of are so concerned all the time.
Right.
You know, one thing I liked about your book was that you actually, you know, gave the reader a chance to find out if, in this case, they were a helicopter parent. You've got a list of questions there that if you answer and you get a certain score, then you are or you're not. I like that. But one of the features of the book also was this idea of the way we treat our kids in terms of everything they do is terrific and we don't want them to feel disappointed or hurt or, in essence, fail. Where does that go wrong?
Well, you know, there's a phenomenon. You know, I can remember growing up and, you know, you'd get a first, second, or third place prize, mm-hmm. right? And whatever the activity was. And I can remember sitting in gymnastics meets with my children and seeing 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, and 11th place, right? Being called up to be recognized.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess it was in the 70s or 80s, people decided that our children's egos were too fragile to think that they hadn't succeeded, but that's not how life is. And so what you're doing is by continually praising your child, oh, they've done a great job, when they really haven't done a standout job, you know, the expectation is when they leave home, they're going to continue to have that, hey, you did a great job. Hey, you get an A just for showing up. And their feelings are really hurt and they're unprepared when they don't get the continued praise when they go off to university. So you're really setting them up for some very difficult times if you're not there to maintain that level of praise. And of course, that doesn't happen in the real world.
Well, you know, I don't know about you, Allison, but in my life, I constantly got awards for most improved. So, you know, I never really excelled at sports and that type of thing, but they always let me know that I mattered. you mentioned something called the grit formula in your book. Take us through that.
Sure. So the grit formula is the 4-step strategy I use to help parents, because you know, my book is really about the how-to, right? Here's where we are. Now, what are we going to do about it? So it's the how-to on how we can really support our kids and get them ready, not only for college, but also for life. So first of all, grit just means hard work, and it is hard work. And they're going to have to put the hard work in as students, and we're going to put the hard work in as parents. But also, G stands for game plan. Have you got a game plan? What's your game plan when you get to college? What's your game plan for life? You know, if I were to say to you, you know, hey, Steve, I have an opportunity for you, right? You're a financial advisor. Mm-hmm. I have an opportunity. If you were to invest $100,000 in this opportunity that I have, now, I can't be sure what the return on investment is going to be. And after 4 years, you might have to give me some additional money. You'd probably say, what the heck, Allison, I'm not signing up for that, right? You're a savvy financial guy. But as parents, we do it all the time. Our kids go off to school. It's going to be at least $100,000 that you may or may not be paying for all of it. But, mm-hmm. you know, perhaps you're contributing to it and you have no idea what you're getting out of it.
Yeah.
So you got to sit down and have a game plan when you start off. The R stands for resourceful. And this is really a skill that our teens, we all need. And there's so many things that we can do to be more resourceful. But it's absolutely critical because, you know, life is going to throw us some curveballs. And we have to know how to get back up on the horse and figure out, you know, how to move forward. So in my book, I give 7 different strategies on how our teens can become more resourceful.
Give me one example of that.
One of the big things that they need to do is to self-advocate. So what does that mean? You know, I've heard this many times from friends of mine who are high school teachers or college professors, in that the student's parent will call in and say, hey, my kid didn't get a good grade. I want to know why or what they can do.
Yeah.
Well, there's nothing wrong with fighting for your grade, but it needs to be the student who is fighting for the grade.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I even heard a story this summer of a woman who's in human resources at a very large consumer packaged goods company outside of Chicago. And one of the MBA students who had gone to a blue chip MBA program had finished the summer internship, had received an offer, and the following week, the student's parent called up to negotiate the offer. Now, this is a person who's got to be around 25 years old, has already worked, has excelled at one of the top business schools, mm-hmm. and has already gotten the job offer, and is still, their parent is so involved that they're negotiating. Yeah. So it's really incumbent upon our students to self-advocate.
Yeah, it's really interesting. That reminds me that personally, many, many years ago when I got into the investment business, I didn't know anything about investments. I didn't know anything about money or anything. My family had no clue how to save, how to invest. As a matter of fact, I always say that whenever we talked about stocks, the only thing I ever heard was stocks were bad.
Mm.
And people jumped out of windows. That was the extent of our ability to understand that. But I do remember when I went for my first job in the industry and I was offered X, and just out of the top of my head, I said, no, I want Y. And they hired me. And I asked later, why did you hire me? And he said, because you negotiated. Because, you know, they saw something in that, which meant that I, you know, was resourceful. And I guess I self-advocated and I didn't even know it.
Right.
Interesting stuff. My guest is Allison Hawkins Ward. The book is Please Don't Come Home, Except for a Visit, A Field Guide to Creating Independent Adults. One of the statements that you make in the book, which got my attention, was that it is better to praise for effort instead of praising for intelligence. And you cite a test that was given.
Well, if you're not familiar with Carol Dweck and her book on mindset, I would encourage everyone to run out and to read that. And that's the study that I refer to. What's so important is when people are praised for intelligence, a couple of things. One, that they may or may not have come onto that of any effort of their own. They just might be gifted. They might have the ability to memorize things very easily, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing that they've done to garner that. So one, we always want to improve. I know you were making a joke about the most self-improved, but we do want to improve. We do want to strive. We do want to continue to grow. And so we always want to praise that effort. The other thing that happens is when people are praised for intelligence, they can also be afraid that, well, if I'm not intelligent, maybe I won't be valued. Maybe mom or dad or teacher won't think very highly of me.
I see.
So I better always be intelligent, or I better always appear to be intelligent, and I might cut corners to get there.
Oh, okay. So you want to praise for effort. Why?
You want to praise for effort because one, you want to continue to, and this is what Carol Dweck's book is about, is the growth mindset. So you want to continue the effort. You want to continue the journey of continuing to grow and improving. And so we want to make sure that we recognize that you've taken some effort here, and we want to continue to celebrate that so we continue along that path.
In the test that you explained in the book, there were two groups, and one group, I guess I'd like you to tell the story, but they were, you know, they were told to work hard and they were reinforced for their hard work. And the other group was told that they were intelligent. And when then the next part of the test, they were given a choice of certain tasks. Tell us about the outcome on that.
Right. So the student who had been praised for hard work said when a new opportunity came along, and they had the opportunity to do the same thing again or to do something new, they were ready to go on and take on the new challenge, right? Because they were like, oh, okay, you know, I got this. And they were ready to take on the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of what I said before. The student who was praised for intelligence was afraid of looking bad. So they just wanted to continue to stay the same level. And of course, we always want to continue to move on to another level and to continue to grow. So we want to make sure we're setting them up to succeed and to perform that way.
Also, I think one of the outcomes was the one that was praised for intelligence actually took the easier tasks.
Yes.
Yes. I think that's really vital.
Exactly, because they're afraid to lose face. They don't want to lose the face of, well, wait, I was intelligent, so I want to just do something that I know I can achieve that. And so, you know, many times we've got to break new ground. That's how we continue to get ahead. We start new businesses, how we grow in our, you know, we grow in our work is taking on new tasks.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to ask you this one question because this comes up a lot when I'm talking with entrepreneurs and reading about entrepreneurs. How important is failure in the building of self-esteem?
Failure is very important here. And what's really most important as parents is supporting our children through failure. So a couple of things. One, people who are very successful, you know, you look at our top entrepreneurs, the thing that they know is that failing does not mean that they are a failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's such an important distinction.
Yeah.
It's a huge difference. And so it's not just that failing is important. It's understanding failing does not mean that they're a failure.
Right.
And as parents, we need to make sure we make that distinction for our children. You can look at any example of business or sports or, you know, or the arts, and every one of them can point to, by failing, they worked harder, they mm-hmm. retooled, they, you know, thought of it a different way, they picked out different resources so that they can move forward. If you're constantly succeeding, you're not striving as high, right?
Yeah, and you get back to that point of resilience.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Because when you go off to, especially think about it, you go off to university and you've never failed. And the first time, you know, especially if you go to a more competitive school, and I think this is probably the case anywhere, but let's say you go to a more competitive school, you've been the top of your class,
yeah.
probably your whole, you know, elementary and secondary career. And here you are now, and so is everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And now all of a sudden, you're not getting to be the president of the club.
Yeah.
You might not make the sports team,
yeah.
and you fall apart.
Well, there's nothing like being, you know, when you're the big fish in the small pond, and then you're the small fish. I mean, that I've experienced that myself, and that's a great lesson when growing up. The book is Please Don't Come Home. I love that. Please Don't Come Home, Except for a Visit, A Field Guide to Creating Independent Adults. I highly recommend this book. My guest, Allison Hawkins Ward. Allison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
To hear this conversation again and to find out more about Allison and her book, don't forget to join us at stevepomerantz.com. That's P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z, stevepomerantz.com.